Oh, hi. I'm Emma Goldswell, and I'm your host for Coming Out Stories. We're a podcast from What Goes On Media, and we pretty much do what the name suggests. We bring you real-life stories from right across the LGBTQ plus spectrum every single fortnight. Now, I've sat down with people from all over the globe to hear about those intimate moments when people have discovered who they really are and when they felt brave enough to share that information with a friend or family member. Now, we've made this podcast for 5 years now, and it's a passion project, really, that we have totally self-funded all of this time. But to keep going, we now really need to find sponsors to help it continue. So if you or your company would like to work with Coming Out Stories to help us carry on, please find out more by going to our website, comingoutstoriespodcast.com. That's comingoutstoriespodcast.com. Right, time to crack on with this episode. Now, I've interviewed a few people whose life story reads a bit like a film script, and G-Day, who you're about to meet, definitely falls into expectations. But most of all, expect to be motivated and inspired by a man who never lost his faith in God or in himself, despite the awful things he's been through. If I have one wish for this episode, is that it's listened to by our government here in the UK, who still haven't, after years of promising, banned conversion therapy. Listening to G-Day's story of going through conversion therapy is nothing short of harrowing. I do urge you to listen, though. And although he's from Nigeria, you may be surprised to hear that his conversion therapy for his sexuality happened in London. Right, it's now time to hear from the one and only Reverend G-Day McCauley, or as he likes to be known, the happy, holy homosexual.
I mean, I identify as gay, I'm a cisgender male, and what else can I say? So,
yeah. And your pronouns are he, him.
Oh, my pronouns are he, him. But of course, you know, my favourite pronoun is mama.
Okay.
You know, everyone in my life, you know, in my congregation call me Mama Jide or Reverend Mother. And there's a long story behind it because I also struggled with the impact of patriarchy and toxic masculinity so I gravitate towards my mom's spirit, so to say, my mom's nurture and care. And because also my dad, who is still living, my mom is late, my dad who's still living was very, very harsh. He's very homophobic. Growing up, I felt like I'm often systematically pulled out for punishment, a harsh punishment. I don't know why, but I mean, in adulthood, I did ask my dad, why do you always beat me way too much or excessively? He certainly has no answer. You know, my dad was very violent, especially when he's disciplining the children.
And have you got lots of brothers and sisters?
Not lots. You know, I had two brothers. One is late and one is still alive. And I've got two sisters as well. At home, you know, I think that the mentality of how Africans discipline their children literally includes corporal punishment, lots of beating.
It's a tough upbringing.
It was a tough upbringing, but I still believe that my parents loved all their children. But I think when it comes to the issue of my sexuality, it was very much later. It was a much, much later thing, you know.
So that wasn't relevant to the beating?
No, it wasn't relevant to the beating at all.
Well, let's talk about growing up gay then. I mean, when you were a child and growing up in London, presumably, did you realise that you were different from other kids and that you were going to grow up to be gay?
Actually, I didn't grow up in England. That's the other
thing. Right.
I was born in England. Probably under the age of 3 years old, I was back in Nigeria with my parents. And of course, I grew up in Nigeria. So growing up gay for me did not resonate. However, the knowledge of difference, I've always known the difference when I was about 5 years old. And I think it was to do with things like play, I mean, children grow up and children are very, very clever. And, you know, especially in what I noticed in Nigeria, we have our own play structure. We play doctors and nurses and husband and wives and all of those things. But I think that the realization of my difference is that I often have an envy when the girls are copulating with the boys. I want to move them aside and be that. But I have since understood that, you know, being effeminate or gravitating towards effeminacy as a boy is not necessarily signs of homosexuality. It's signs of knowing that you're different. So what many people now call queer. Because when we understand binary that society has put on us as heteronormative ideals, when you veer away from that, then you begin to notice differences. So as a young child, I would say maybe it's more age appropriate at that time, I understood my difference.
You wanted to play and be the nurse.
I wanted to be the nurse. So, and again, when it comes to play, like sports, I prefer soft play. I didn't like the rough play. You know, I like to take care of myself. I like to be neat. I'm very organized.
And I'm guessing, is it a fairly macho environment growing up in Nigeria? men have got to be men, stereotypical men.
Nigeria is very macho environment, very patriarchal in nature. So the understanding is that boys have to be tough. Boys don't cry. You know, boys take the lead. And it can be quite exhausting for any child that is not interested in that.
Manny, I think it was quite like that in the UK in the 1960s and 70s, you know, and still is to some extent, isn't it?
Absolutely so, because I think that many cultures are enshrined around the power of men. Even, you know, in Christian religion, theologically, you know, we hear more about men's achievement throughout the Bible, but we've forgotten that women exist at the time.
So at what stage did you realise, did the penny drop? You know, it wasn't just that you were different, it was that you were gay.
Age 13, clearly. At age 13, I think that I've become very clear, even in the obscurity of the knowledge in Nigeria, I have come to know that there's something deeply different about me, that I am same-gender loving. And of course, you know, I was having a lot of feelings, you know, to, you know, boys my age. And I was highly experimental as a young person. I wanted to find out more. But I think that also in terms of knowledge, there is not enough literature. There is not enough persons to go to. I mean, when I was growing up, you have to either, you have to go to the library to look for the information. And you cannot ask a librarian about homosexuality. This is something that you have to do on your own.
Well, you wouldn't have had any role models. Am I right in thinking it was and still is illegal?
I mean, it is still illegal in Nigeria, unfortunately. But talking about role models, it's actually non-existence. I mean, people don't talk about homosexuality. Neither do we talk about heterosexuality. Heterosexuality wasn't numb. A boy holding a girl's hand is considered okay. The boy will be celebrated as a Casanova, you know, he will be celebrated in many ways. But I think that the absence of same-gender love, you know, visible to young people in the most positive way is also part of the harm, you know, that's caused many people. I had to live in fear. Now, some of the ways that I got to know about my sexuality was actually through reading the Bible. So,
really?
Yes, when I came across, you know, Bible passages such as Leviticus, Leviticus 18:22 and Leviticus 20:13 clearly says that if a man has sex with another man, it is an abomination and that they should be put to death. Now, that is violence there already. So having to tackle that as a young person was quite damning.
And you were clearly brought up with the Bible.
Yeah.
And so to read that as a young gay person must have been incredibly upsetting and hurtful.
It wasn't just upsetting. It was literally criminal. You know, it set me on a path of rejection and denial. But of course, you know, my sexuality didn't change. What I've often realized is that, you know, we can go through a period of time where we can suppress same-sex feelings, but
which
cannot.
I guess you did. Did you?
Yes, of course. I mean, it was something that I did for many, many years. But the thing about it is that there's often quite a beautiful thing about my growing up as well, because I think around about age 14, 15, I had a boyfriend in Nigeria.
Really?
Yeah, but I didn't know he knew he was my boyfriend. Because we spent all the time together. I just love being in his presence, you know. It was this extremely beautiful brotherly love where, you know, we hug, we are in each other's presence, but there was actually no sexual,
right,
you know, that kind of, because I was very comfortable. Someone that, you know, in Nigeria we say korikosun, meaning that I cannot sleep without seeing you. And that kind of friendship was really deep. You know, we go to school together, we will meet up and then go together, come back to Western most of the time, at least for a period of about a year or so, until we part ways as young people. But of course, that difficulty didn't stop, because having been raised in a very conservative Christian family, being gay was certainly something that was not discussed. And of course, me finding out the scriptures didn't help at all. And there were no religious leaders, including my parents, that I can go to and discuss how I am feeling and how it is bothering me. But and of course, you know, as a young person as well, I was bullied a lot, you know, because I was effeminate. I was effeminate growing up, and I had big foot, I had big lips, and people would taunt me with all of these things, you know. And yeah, there are times where, you know, the bullies will seize my shoe from the beginning of the day, and I have to walk barefooted most of the, and the teachers didn't intervene, you know, no one intervened to help the situation.
Why didn't they intervene? Did you try and report it?
It's difficult to report bullying in Nigeria. I mean, it's very, very difficult. So, and there are so many things that there were missed opportunities. A lot of young people do not get the opportunity to be coached around anti-bullying behavior or how to report bullying. A lot of the teachers are also bullies as well. If they didn't side with the bullies, I would be surprised.
This sounds like a really tough childhood then. I mean, you're being told that you should be put to death because you like men. You're being bullied. No one's supporting you. That's a tough, tough upbringing, right?
I think it was tough because there's also the psychological impact.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I've always often said that, you know, the Bible should be locked away from anyone under the age of 18. I mean, I read the Bible because my family, one, were a Christian family, and we often take part, you know, in Bible quiz and Bible trivias, yeah, and things like that. So we read the Bible for information because we want to make sure that we are winners in my family. So when we go to all this Bible competition. But at the same time, when you're reading the Bible as a young queer person and you're discovering passages and verses like this that you cannot discuss more broadly for a better explanation, it's difficult. I mean, I, as a young person, asked lots of questions, but I didn't get answers.
Well, this is interesting because I think you are the first person that I've interviewed on the podcast who's actually wearing a dog collar. So clearly you have gone on some big journey in terms of recontextualizing the Bible and rethinking the Bible and reassessing what it means. So tell us a bit about that journey.
Thank you so much. I mean, of course, you know, my dog collar is because I've been praying this morning already.
Cool.
You know, I've had time of prayer online. But I think that the reality is that not just the fact that I was born into a Christian family, I've also had a desire from a very young age, around about age 13 as well, to become a Christian minister. My dad is a Christian minister. That was not necessarily the reason that I am a Christian minister. I've always wanted to be a Christian minister in my own right. But of course, you know, getting to know who I am became very difficult because I've come to understand that there are certain tick boxes or there are certain criteria for someone who's going to be a minister. You have to be, my understanding, even aligned with my culture, the African culture, you have to be a married man, you know. But I was doing a lot of ministerial work even before I was married. I was providing relationship counseling when I was a very young teenager to grown people that were married. I was providing marriage counseling and prayers. So I think that sometimes there's a misplaced list of criteria and priorities for ministry. But having said that, I've always had the desire to be a pastor.
Wow.
a priest.
But to someone like me who doesn't have a faith, I find it really hard to understand how you would accept that faith when that book tells you that you should be put to death. I can't square it.
This is why we're having this conversation today, I believe. And I think that, you know, it is not the book that is telling people to be put to death. It is the understanding of the book, the interpretation of the book. Mm. And unfortunately, the book has been misused, mistranslated for many, many years, if not centuries. Mm. Now, let's be clear. The two verses in Leviticus that I quoted was not intended or meant for Christians, nor is it meant for anyone today. The Israelites were coming out of Egypt, where they've been in bondage for 400 years. They have been completely depleted. But in order to repopulate the Israelite communities, they were asked not to have sex with men. And it was only for that particular group of people, not for anyone else. And let's be mindful, there are other communities that existed outside of the Israelites. For example, you know, the Bible says that God gave them the promised land, the land of Canaan. People were living in Canaan before they were moved there.
Probably gay people as well.
Probably gay people. and we have to, people need to understand that the Bible is open to questioning. Yeah. The Bible is open to scrutiny as well. Mm. Because if we go back to, say, for example, the creation story, we are often told that God created Adam and Eve. As Eve, God only created two people ever. Would it be then surprising that when Cain took a wife, he took a wife outside of his own family from another group of people that existed that no one has told us about them, or no one has actually raised the fact that these people existed?
Yes, there are questions, aren't there? Yeah. You must get sick of that homophobic chant. It's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. But that's been thrown at gay people for a long time, hasn't it, that little ditty?
I no longer get sick of it. I just say to them, you know, God made Adam and Steve and Madam and Evelyn as well. I think that the reality for the creation story is to let people know that God created human beings, diverse people, diverse race, diverse cultures in places around the world. And I think that, you know, the Christian understanding is also to ensure that we continue to talk about the unimaginable love of God for God's creation, because the Bible also tells us in the book of Psalms that for we are fearfully and wonderfully made. God has made every single individual beautifully made. And that's the message that I often want to highlight. I mean, the hatred that we see today,
I was going to say, has made some people very homophobic and transphobic though, hasn't he?
I mean, it has. I mean, unfortunately, but I think that we also need to focus on the inclusive gospel. You know, every Sunday, especially during this ordinary time in the Anglican Church, you know, in my parish, we remind people that Jesus said, Jesus gave us two commandments. He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. The second one is to love your neighbors as yourself. And Jesus said so many things about love. Jesus even said that what good is it to love those who love you? Love your enemies. Because when people love you, it's guaranteed. They can never unlove you. But, I mean, the biggest challenge for Christians, even those homophobic Christians, is that if they would take one day to love the LGBT, non-binary, non-conforming person, it will change their life.
Have you had any problems being an out gay Christian? Have you had problems being accepted within the church as a gay priest?
It was a journey of acceptance as a gay man. I mean, obviously, I was excommunicated multiple times in my primary church communities because of my sexuality.
You know, this is when you were back in Nigeria? So.
Well, I mean, obviously, I didn't come out as gay until I moved to England, and I was then part of a church community here in England, you know, for several years. Before I came out as gay. And even at that time, I was already in a relationship with a woman. I got married, then we had a child. Yes, before I came out as gay. And of course, when I came out as gay, words went back to the church and I was excommunicated from the church.
Oh. Right, well, let's talk about this period of time then. So how old were you when you finally came out? I'm guessing that there's a lot of years of hiding yourself because you're in Nigeria and because of...
Yeah,
it was illegal and nobody talked about it and all the rest of the issues.
I think the transition from Nigeria to the UK was in my late teens, early 20s. And I think I got into a relationship with the woman who became my wife around about when I was 20 years old. So I got married to her when I was 24 years old.
Because you thought it was the right thing to do? Because you knew you were gay?
Because, one, I thought it was the right thing to do, and because I have been through a period of fasting and praying away my homosexuality with the hope that God would cure me. And when I finally had a girlfriend, I naively believed that God had performed the miracle that since I have a girlfriend and I'm no longer gay. That is one of the most... That was one of the most... I can't even find the word. It was one of the most personal, deceptive thing that has ever happened to me, because I didn't know better. I did not have the grace and the opportunity to sit down with somebody to provide me with appropriate pastoral care in understanding my own sexuality.
Wow. That's a lot, isn't it?
So
you thought you could pray the gay away.
I thought I could, because this is one of the teachings in my community. Yeah. You know, I've had many people, you know, religious leaders say, you can pray away, you can fast. I fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. Listen, when Jesus Christ, after his baptism, he went into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights to pray. And he, quote unquote, was able to conquer the devil. So to say, I believe at one point that my homosexual feelings was really the devil's work. So I needed to fight against it. So fasting and praying for 40 days and 40 nights was the answer. But I felt that when I had a girlfriend, that I'm no longer gay. But it didn't last long, because, you know, I had a 7-year relationship with this girl. And the first 4 years, we were boyfriend and girlfriends. And then the last 3 years, we were legally married. And then we had a child together. Throughout the whole 7 years of that relationship, I was in deep trouble mentally, psychologically, and emotionally, because I was struggling with my sexuality.
And were you talking to anybody about it?
Unfortunately, no. And that was it was like a sinking ship. Yeah. You know, I was so, so depressed. But I was not able to communicate my depression in order for me to get out. I think it was at the point of real depression that I had to sit my ex-wife down to say, look, there's something I want to tell you that I'm gay. And of course, you know, she couldn't handle it. She said, I can't compete with this. And she was right. There's nothing that she can give me emotionally, mentally, or even sexually that, you know, she's a woman, and that hasn't worked for me, or it couldn't work for me. So we parted ways, and unfortunately, our relationship became a little bit more acrimonious because she got upset. We were very young when we started dating.
So was she the first person you told then?
Yes, she was the first person I told.
Wow.
So that was really difficult.
I bet that was very difficult to just build up to it and say the words.
It was difficult, but I didn't even know how we started the conversation. I just knew that there was something I needed to talk to her about. But that reality for me is that, you know, I've always known that I'm gay. And, you know, when people hear my story, I did not enter into a relationship with her to hide who I am. I truly believe that, you know, being a Christian and being African requires me to be with a woman. Yeah. You know, if I knew what I knew today, I certainly wouldn't have been in a relationship with a woman, because I want to have a fulfilling life and be very happy as a gay man.
So do you ever see her or your son again?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, my relationship with my ex-wife and my son has taken a very different turn. I'm no longer in touch with her at all. I'm unfortunately no longer in touch with my own son as well. And I think that reality is because my son had developed very extremely homophobic attitude. And in as much as I get a lot of homophobia from the world, I don't want it from my own child. But I always say this, that, you know, my heart is open with love to my child. And anytime he's prepared to have this conversation, very, very loving conversation, nothing to do with sexuality, I'm quite open to that. But I think that the reality for many is that we forget that, you know, having a biological child, you know, that doesn't want you, doesn't make you a bad person, you know. It's quite painful, but at the same time, I have gained so much more. And I know that sometimes people say that, you know, blood is thicker than water, but I still believe that I am raising other young people, you know, who are queer, even some that are not queer, who are in my life as well. You understand me? Who understand, you know, the need of parenting and being a child or someone that is nurtured and mentored by an adult.
Gosh, it's interesting. I've spoken to a lot of people who have been rejected by their parents, but I think you're the first person I've spoken to where it's the other way around, you know, and either way, it's tough and it's hard. It must be really heartbreaking.
I mean, unfortunately, I've been rejected by both a parent and my child. So my dad has rejected me. My father is extremely homophobic. My son is homophobic. I mean, these are two men on either side of my life.
Wow.
So it's not easy, but I mean, I think I also want people to know that I am not in a place of pain. I am fulfilled. I am very happy. I love God. I love my ministry. And, you know, I want people to know that. But I know that relationship with family is very important for many. But rather than it drag me down, I have lifted myself up literally above the pain that my son and my father has inflicted on me.
It's so good to hear that. And I've spoken to so many people, and it's kind of why I wanted to do the podcast, really, just to show that, you know, on the very rare occasions where it does go horribly wrong and you are rejected by family, people end up leading very happy gay lives, you know, and they find their own family. And you've really done that, you know, with your church and with all the people that you've met. Yeah. So that is really good to hear. Let's just rewind slightly. So when you got divorced from your wife, how did your life change? Did you start opening up and telling friends and telling other people?
No, actually, after the divorce and separation and divorce, it wasn't easy to tell people. I certainly had queer friends, you know, for most of my life.
Yeah.
But my relationship with my queer friends was very strange because this is the days we didn't have mobile phones.
Yeah.
So a lot of my gay friends, you know, if we're going to socialize, you know, they'll call the house.
Yeah.
And then if my wife pick up the phone, she hand the phone to me, then I'm on the phone, just a few words, you know, about, oh, we're socializing this weekend, or we're going out, you know, to a picnic, or we're going out to a party or something like that. And but I saw my queer friends developing in a way that I wanted to, but here I am stuck in a wedding, in a marriage, so to say. Now, of course, I think that after coming out, it wasn't easy. I think after coming out, I went into a very dark place again, because the question that hit me when I came out is, now that I've come out, what does a new gay do?
Yeah.
Where do I go? So now this is the time to now find where the resources are.
Yeah.
As a Christian boy who's gay, throughout my upbringing, we were told that the club places are the place of the devil. I've been brought up in Christian denominations where smoking and drinking is an abomination.
So you weren't going to go and find the nearest gay club then?
No. So basically, when I started to go to the bars and the clubs, they didn't fit in with my identity as a Christian because everyone smoked. These are the days, if anyone's listening to this, they can actually tell how old I am without telling my age. This was the days where we were allowed to smoke inside the club.
I remember it. Oh, I remember.
It was awful.
And you'd wake up in the morning and your whole bed and your hair would smell of cigarettes.
Exactly.
Even if you didn't smoke, you would just smell of it. Yeah, it was horrible.
And but thank God they've ruled that all out. But I think that, you know, again, the club spaces, the bars, I didn't drink alcohol. I didn't smoke cigarettes. So it was really depleting for me. It didn't help. Now, the other thing is also trying to find the communities. As a black gay man, I was finding the communities of white gay men.
Yeah. And where were you living in the UK?
I was in London.
You were in London?
I was in London. So
you still couldn't find a good gay community.
I was separated and divorced in 1994. So at that time, there were no well-organized groups of black queer people.
No.
There's none in 94. I couldn't find any. You know, there were small groups, like within groups. There was a group called Big Up that was like within a larger group of GMFA, for example. I couldn't find them. Now, of course, you know, for a couple of years, I didn't go to church and decided to go back to church again, a Pentecostal church in East London. When I found this church, I was very happy, you know, with a larger Nigerian community. But I decided to keep my sexuality away from the church. So it's the second time I'm doing this kind of like double take, where I am now living deliberately or intentionally living a secret life. So I'll go to church as a prim and proper Christian, but away from church, I'm gay. So you can see, you know, the double standard and the double life. Yeah. And of course, when I'm in church and people will make comments like, oh, Judy, you're looking beautiful, or your clothes is well ironed, I probably think, oh my God, are they making a pass at me? Things like that. And it became really uncomfortable. Unfortunately, 4 years after I've really immersed myself in this church community, they found out that I was gay and I was excommunicated. This time, worse than the first one, I was subjected to conversion therapy. Yes, where I was physically beaten.
What?
And the physical beating was in order to beat out the homosexuality in
This was in London?
This was in London.
In the 1990s?
This was actually 2000.
What?
Yeah, this is actually the year 2000 now, because we're now in the noughties. Now, I think that for me, honestly, when I look back at the physical beating, I agreed to it. I submitted myself to it because I was concerned that if I didn't, they would not help me. They cannot help me. And I was extremely broken and emotional, where I was even appealing and begging them to help me get rid of my homosexuality. Now, imagine that space of time would have been about 6 years, 6-7 years after I came out as gay.
So how old were you now? In your 30s?
Goodness me. I think, yes. I was probably like, maybe, what, year 2000, how old am I? Good. I can't even work out my own age anymore. I think I was in like my mid-30s now.
Wow. Yeah. And you're someone that had already tried to, you know, starve yourself and pray the gay away years before.
Absolutely.
So you kind of knew that it didn't work, but you were, I guess you were just desperate to fit in, were you?
I was desperate to fit in. And of course, you know, all of these things just didn't help. Now, I think that for me, the other thing again is that after I left the church again, you know, I carried on with my life. If I go back just a couple of years, between 96 and 98, I started to do the theological training at my father's church.
All of this still didn't put you off religion?
It still did not put me off religion.
That's quite incredible, do you know? I mean, you were physically beaten by members of your congregation. Were you injured?
I wouldn't say I was injured, but of course, it was painful. It wasn't just the members of the, these were the leaders of the congregation. So it was a prayer time. We will pray. There's something called spiritual mapping, where we have maps of London on the wall and we lay hands on different areas. So we pray with areas where we've known for drug, you know, cartels. We pray for areas where there's high sex work. We pray for areas that has knife crime, gun crime. But I was shocked when there was an area like Soho for homosexuality.
Yeah.
And we were invited to pray against the spirit of homosexuality in this area. And I was in the room. I took a seat because I didn't think that I could pray. So, and then people came to me and said, Jide, why are you not praying against the spirit of homosexuality? In this moment, I didn't have the burden. I'm tired of your homophobia. I didn't have the burden. So again, that put me, you know, in conflict, in loggerhead with these leaders. And, you know, it was time for them to start to do the radical healing process for me.
So we're doing this interview in 2023.
Yes.
And our government still haven't made conversion therapy illegal. What do you think of that?
I think it's rather unfortunate that the UK government, especially this current administration, you know, in 2023, have conceded that banning conversion therapy is not the priority. It has been a priority for a long time. And I think that it puts the LGBT people's life at risk, especially within religious spaces. And I think it's important that it's not just the, you know, not just the society, not just the non-religious spaces, but religious spaces as well. Unfortunately, within religious spaces, they believe that they can stand behind the pulpit or behind a sacred book, you know, to promote this level of hatred. Conversion therapy indicates that something needs to be corrected. For lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, non-conforming, non-affirming people, there is nothing to correct.
Exactly.
There's nothing to correct. In fact,
I will say amen to that.
Thank you so much. There's nothing to correct. I think that what we need is to correct the mindset of those who think or feel yeah. that queer people need all these changes.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, as a Christian myself, it's something that I struggle with, how people think about queer people. But I still believe that God is merciful, God is kind, and God is wonderful. And that's why for many years of my own ministry, I continue to emphasize that, you know, G-A-Y means God adores you, God accepts you,
I like that.
God affirm you, yeah. God anoint you. I believe that people should come just the way they are to God. And that is so profound. If we are not able to be ourselves, you know, within safe communities and the church in particular, a lot of people will travel across town where they will find drugs, they will fall into abusive behavior, you know, they will fall into abusive relationships, and, you know, they will find themselves homeless and destitute. But in any community, it is important that people are embraced just the way they are.
And you've gone on to set up your own ministry, set up your own very inclusive church, haven't you? What can you tell us about that?
Thank you. I mean, House of Rainbow is an inclusive fellowship. I'm also a priest in the Church of England and, you know, in Manchester now. And Manchester as a diocese is very inclusive and, you know, to the large extent. However, House of Rainbow has been a great part of my journey for the last 17 years.
Wow.
Right. Now, the primary purpose for House of Rainbow is to support the pastoral care of reconciling faith and sexuality for LGBT Christians. And House of Rainbow also started in Nigeria, in the very place where I've been told that I am an abomination, many people are not. We started in Nigeria 17 years ago. Now, for me, that reality was so important because the grace for House of Rainbow is the ability to support people, support families, support religious leaders on that journey of understanding that LGBT people are also children of God.
And how are you able to do that then if it's still illegal in Nigeria?
I mean, the laws are illegal. The love of God is not illegal. The love of God is free for all believers, you know. And I think that, you know, that people feel that they have the authority of God. Let's be clear. No one has the monopoly to the presence of God.
Yeah.
Everyone can choose how they relate with God.
And how has that gone down in Nigeria then? Has it been?
It hasn't gone down well. Let's be realistic. It hasn't gone down well. In fact, you know, the state church and many big organizations, you know, have actually attacked, you know, the idea of House of Rainbow in Nigeria. And unfortunately, Nigeria has inherited the British colonial laws as well, which has impacted on behavior.
Oh, that's true. We're very aware it's our fault. Don't worry. Yeah. It's not good, is it?
It has impacted the attitude of people in Nigeria. And unfortunately, in 2014, the Nigerian government introduced what is called Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act, which goes further to prohibit gay marriage in Nigeria.
Yeah.
But of course, Nigeria being a society, in my opinion, something that doesn't even understand human sexuality, let alone understand how to react to it, you know, react very badly. In Nigeria, there is something called jungle justice. And that's where ordinary people take the law into their hands. So if it's perceived or rumored or confirmed that someone is gay, you know, vigilantes in Nigeria can pick them up, beat them up, if possible, kill them. And we have had, you know, unexplained death. There's a high rate of suicide in places like Nigeria. I mean, a few weeks ago, about 200 LGBT-identified persons were arrested at a party. All they want to do is dance, but because they were queer-identified, they were arrested, you know, paraded in front of the world media, humiliated, just because there is a law that proposed that it is wrong. And I think that, again, Nigerians generally do not understand how to interpret those laws. It is same-sex marriage prohibition. People dancing are not getting married. It's not illegal to dance. I mean, House of Rainbow in Nigeria suffered because of the attacks, the threats. But we believe that there's nothing in the Nigerian constitution that stops queer people coming together to pray.
So do you go back there regularly?
Unfortunately, no. I've not been to Nigeria since 2012. I would love to visit Nigeria. I would love to go back to Nigeria and still do much more important work in Nigeria, yes. But I'm very concerned for my safety and for the safety of others who may hang around me in Nigeria. But I think that the reality for many is that, unfortunately, Nigerians generally still hold views that homosexuality is not permitted in the country and that it's an abomination.
Including your dad, who still lives there, I presume?
I mean, the story with my dad is even more worse. My dad colluded or was a partner to the same-sex marriage prohibition bill in Nigeria. My father worked with the Nigerian government to make sure that there is a law against homosexuality in Nigeria, and he celebrated it quite publicly in the media. And I was quite surprised because when I moved back to Nigeria in 2006, it became clear to me that my father is working with the Nigerian government because he felt that it is his responsibility as a religious leader to advise government to ensure that there are laws. When my dad was probed about his involvement with this particular legislation, and also when he was challenged about the penalties of 14 years imprisonment with hard labor and also conversion therapy, my father suggested that if I, his son, were to get shock therapy, I would come back to my senses.
Wow. So is he publicly admits that he has a gay son, does he?
There's no doubt about that, because I was even out public in the press. So there were numerous headlines in Nigeria, you know, with my photograph on front page, you know, with headings like abomination, inside Lagos church where Bible turned upside down. There were just so many press statements. But of course, you know, it was linked, you know, every newspaper would mention my father and myself. Okay. I think one of the first breaking news was in Wall Street Journal, New York. The headline was "Anti-Gay Bill Divides Family," and it was two interviews. The journalist had interviewed myself and my dad, and this was really early on. This was actually early 2007.
Wow.
And of course, you know, following that breaking news, I was also present in the Nigerian parliament when they had the public debate on the 2006 anti-gay bill, where I had stood up in the Nigerian parliament to defend the LGBT community and indeed to appeal to the Nigerian government not to make this bill into law. But as the time progresses, you know, there was a change of course. I unfortunately had to flee Nigeria at the end of 2008 because my life was threatened. My home was vandalized, and if I was in that home when it was vandalized, I would have been killed. But of course, you know, I mean, I don't know what role my father is playing in this. And that is why since 2012, when I've heard more about my father's involvement, you know, with the bill, I've decided not to go to Nigeria because on one hand, I cannot trust him. Nigeria doesn't have a system of justice. If I were to die in Nigeria, there would be no autopsy. I would have been hurriedly buried. And, you know, people say, oh, he died.
Oh my gosh.
And that is a concern. That is why I've always said that, you know, I do not take my privilege as a British citizen for granted, because I knew that, you know, whilst I was in Nigeria, I was able to leave Nigeria, just go to the airport, get a plane ticket and leave. But that wasn't the intention when I moved to Nigeria to start the Ministry of House of Rainbow.
I mean, and you must be so worried for other people who can't have that privilege
to get on a plane to the
UK.
Very, very worried, because when I left the country, a lot of people were displaced. People lost their job because of the association with House of Rainbow. A lot of photographs from our services, even video recordings, secretly recorded, were circulating on social media, you know, in the press. And a lot of people were evicted from their homes, rejected by their families. It was quite painful. But having said that, you know, I've never stopped the work of House of Rainbow. There was a time up to about 2015 that we had about 7 to 9 worship group in Nigeria, but they had to go underground. But at the moment, we actually have zero presence in Nigeria apart from online. And it's simply because a lot of the leaders who were leading the group in all the 79 places, you know, were also displaced. There is not enough funding to support them. Many of them have moved abroad as well to safer environments, which we fully supported as an organization. Mm-hmm. But of course, that also leaves a gap of those who are still in the country that are yearning and looking for safe spaces. But of course, you know, when the pandemic happened, you know, a few years ago, we started to organize online. So now House of Rainbow have an online presence. We have a weekly meeting every Sunday at 7 a.m. using Clubhouse as a platform. And we get people from all over the world, mostly from Nigeria, who come into that meeting every Sunday for their own nourishment and well-being.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Really good. What did your dad actually say to you when you told him you were gay? Did he find out or did he have a conversation?
I think the conversation with my dad was very different. When I separated and divorced my ex-wife in 1994, it was 3 years later that my mother asked me directly if I was gay. And I think by that time I was ready because it's like 3 years after my divorce. So I told my mom, yes, I'm gay. My mom's response even shocked me. She said, why didn't you tell me that for the last 3 years she has been praying for another wife when she could have been praying for a husband? Now, honestly, I mean, my mother, she was absolutely hilarious. Mm-hmm. But again, my relationship with my mother was incredibly amazing because not only did she accept me, she also accepted all my lesbian friends, my gay friends, you know. So we literally, like, spent time in my mother's house. My mother's house became like the queer safe space in Kilburn in London. Now, of course, you know, it was then another 5 years after my mother had asked me that my father then had that conversation.
Were they not
with.
Together?
No, they were not together. Yes. My mom lived in England, my dad lived in Nigeria. Oh, okay. But you see, the irony of it is that when I separated from my ex-wife, I really wanted to reconnect with my dad in a way, like a father-son relationship. Yeah. I wanted to have that difficult conversation with him. But I remember in 96, you know, when I met with my dad, rather than courageously have the conversation about my sexuality and the deep trouble that I'm having, we started to talk about my theological development. And then I just enrolled for theological studies at his school. So the next 2 years, I was doing a lot of theological studies. My father ordained me in 1998 in his ministry. So it's been 25 years, you know, to this year that I was ordained at my father's. My father was so proud and happy that his son had been ordained, following in his footsteps. Mm. Now, what my son and the ordination council did not recognize is the deep pain that I was going through whilst I was developing my theological studies as well. And of course, you know, a lot of things that I was taught in my father's theological training were also deeply harmful. So I couldn't embody the role of a minister after my ordination. So when I returned to England, you know, I will only wear my clerical collar only when it's necessary or when I'm going to an event. I did not develop a church following the ordination and my father's ministry. Now, in 2001 or 2002, I was introduced to the Metropolitan Community Church. And it was at this church that I started to ask questions about reconciling my faith and my sexuality. And of course, I would say, look, you know, I'm already ordained. You know, can I transfer my clerical credentials to this ministry? And because I was learning more about God's love for queer people in the Metropolitan Community Church, it made sense to me. And the more I was learning, the more I really also wanted to have this conversation with my father. In 2003, my father was visiting England, as he often does. And this was the time that he sat me down to ask me questions about my sexuality because he's been hearing things. Now, of course, you know, when an African father especially is talking to their child, you do not talk back. As my father spoke with me, his words were harsh.
But did he ask you outright whether you were gay?
No, he just told me that he's heard that I'm gay and that it's an abomination, it's a disgrace to his name and his family. He's got reputation to protect and that I should stop. I should find myself another woman and stop this nonsense. Those were his words.
And what did you say back to him?
Nothing. Just tears. I was broken. I was broken. I mean, it was deep. I wish I can share with you verbatim what it said, because again, I struggled just to put all of these things behind my mind. But I think that they were very harsh words. They were, you know, it was more about him than about me and what I might be going through or how I understood my sexuality. A lot of things that I talk about today, about how I discovered my sexuality at the age 13, I think my father should have been there, you know, for me to say, my child, no, that's not what the Bible is saying. You know, I mean, if my father knew that I was gay at 13, what would he have done? He found out I was gay in my 30s. So I'm a grown adult, married and divorced with a child, and he now want to have a say in my sexuality. I think that is actually misplaced priorities at that point. You know,
but your mum had the right idea, didn't she? Praying for a husband.
Absolutely.
Did you ever get a husband?
I'm still waiting for that, to be honest. But I think that, I mean, that reality for me is just that, I think that my father, as a theologian himself, and an academic, is like missed opportunities, because he could have had an extremely revolutionary opportunity to even help Nigerians and Nigerians address the issue of homosexuality if he had looked at it from a theological perspective, even if he did not agree with homosexuality. But let's have a symposium that will discuss this. Let's have a theological research and then work with people on both sides of this. But he was quite clear. He had one position and is not prepared to shift. I was hopeful. I was expecting, but you can force the horse to the river, but you can't force it to drink.
Right.
So when my mom passed away in 2013, my father blamed my homosexuality on my mother's death.
What?
Yeah, my father has said things to my son, you know, about my sexuality that made my son turn his mind against me. My father had said to my family that they should never go to my church because it's a church of the devil. You know, I mean, things like that are painful to hear from your own parents. But at the same time, I still have the deep love for my father. I just want to let go, you know, of that pain, because I don't think that I want that to be part of my own reality.
Gosh, you've gone on such a journey. I just can't. I'm blown away by your story, and I'm just so impressed that you are such a happy, healthy homosexual now, and you know, you're thriving, and your church is thriving. Maybe we should end with some advice for other people who are maybe growing up with intolerant parents or children. What would be your advice be to them, people who are growing up and being told that they're wrong, being told that they're an abomination?
I think before we get to that, intolerant, I think there's something that's very, very important that I also want to share. You know, in the same year that my father was challenging me about my sexuality in 2003, this was actually around about summertime. That same year in January, you know, I went for a routine blood test and health check, and the result came back that I was HIV positive.
Gosh.
And of course, you know, up to that time, you know, I have lived under the rhetorics of homosexuality is an abomination and that God is punishing homosexuals with HIV. So the moment anyone come out as gay, the first thing that people say is that you must be HIV positive as well. And unfortunately, that's not true. HIV is a virus. So I was exposed to the virus, no doubts about that. But I think that, you know, the diagnosis also changed the way that I was thinking and on my own journey. And be mindful, this was 2003. 3 years later, I moved to Nigeria to start House of Rainbow.
Wow.
I did not let the virus stop me in developing. I have also since had multiple theological degrees. I have been ordained as a priest in the Church of England.
You've not let it stop you, quite right.
I've not allowed it to get in the way of the progress that I'm able to make in this life and contribute to life. But having said that, you know, I mean, I want to say to people that it is important that we stand up as our own individuals. You know, find your tribe, find your family of choice. Your DNA family are amazing, but sometimes they may not necessarily give you what you need. Now, of course, you know, I've been through so many achievements, so many milestones that none of my families were there, but my goddaughter, my godson, you know, their family, you know, my community were there. I mean, if I'm doing anything today and I go to the gay community, I will get a lot of love, you know. So I want to say to people that, you know, regardless of what you go through, regardless of how people respond to your sexuality or even your HIV status, know that there are people that truly care for you and love you. And of course, I'm not saying that we should stand around on our own. No, we have incredible communities. You know, I'm part of, you know, the peer support in this community here in Manchester. I'm part of the HIV peer support. I provide HIV mentoring to others. You know, I receive that peer support back in different other communities. So I think it's important that we find our space so that, you know, we don't feel depressed or lonely. And of course, if anyone is wanting or willing to continue their faith as a Christian, Muslim, there are communities that are progressive. And it's the same as well, if you do not want to follow any religion, it is okay. You know, you are equally loved, and I don't think anyone should be forced into anything they don't want to. It's so important that people are aware of who they are. For me, it's my blackness, my sexuality, my Christian faith, my HIV status has literally been a source of joy to many and information to many. I'm very grateful to God that I have the ability to flip someone's depression around, you know, especially if you're gay. I've had families come to me, parents come to me to talk about their queer children, where we've had deep conversations about the love of God for their children and queer children being a gift from God. You didn't have a choice in that. You know, you unwrapped the gift, you accepted the gift, and the gift turned out to be a trans child or a lesbian child or a gay child. It is your gift. You aren't going to throw it away now. You know, you need to love it or learn to love it. Because the challenge is that we live in a society that is so negative that they want to blindfold us from all the positivity. I mean, when I have some of my peer support group and you hear queer men, you know, talk about their relationship with their fathers and their mothers in the most positive way, it's incredible. You know, so I think that society is just deeply afraid of something that doesn't exist. Society creates their own fear. I mean, I've had those challenges. I've had those achievement as well. And I'm always grateful that, you know, anyone can look at me and say, if Jide can do it, I can do it too.
The incredible Jide McCauley there. And I recommend following him on Twitter as well, where he is at Rev Jide, R-E-V-J-I-D-E. And whether you live in Nigeria or not, you really should find out more about his organisation. All you need to do that is go to houseofrainbow.org. What an incredible and brave individual. I don't have a faith, but if I did, I would pray that conversion therapy is banned in all countries across this planet of ours. Don't forget, if you want to work with Coming Out Stories and help sponsor us, please get in contact, and you can do that via our website, comingoutstoriespodcast.com. Please follow us on all the socials as well. We are at Come Out Stories on X, previously known as Twitter. And on Instagram, we are Coming Out Stories Pod. Stick around for the next episode, though, because it's also truly international. I caught up with Luma, who is a refugee activist. She now lives in the US after she sought asylum there when she fled her home country of Jordan because of her sexuality. She ended up becoming a football coach and then set up a nationally acclaimed network of schools for refugee children.
One of my family support staff members was at a family's house, and the dad's like, so I hear that Coach Luma, like, she's, and he couldn't even say it, she's with women, and he's like, she's, and the person's like, she's gay, and he's like, yeah, and he's like, is that true? And she's like, yeah. And he's like, well, that's not okay, and he started going off, and then his wife came in, and she said, you need to shut your mouth. This woman is taking care of your son better than you have. Like, we left our countries because of this judgment that happened there. We're not doing it here.